The Fate of Looted Art. I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Counsel at Wedlake Bell.
And I'm Richard Harwood, I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
I'm Richard Aronovitz, Global Head of Restitution at Christie's Auction House, based in London.
Welcome, Richard. It's lovely to have you with us this morning to talk about your career in the art world and your career as the Global Head of Restitution at Christie's. And of course, novelist and poet, let's not forget. So I thought we'd start by asking you the question which you're so often asked about how your career has led you to be in this important role at Christie's.
I think this work found me. I began my career in the commercial art world as an impressionist and modern art specialist, focusing particularly on German and Austrian 20th century paintings. That's the sort of area of study I'd pursued as a graduate student at the Courtauld Institute, very near here. I began at Sotheby's in 1997, cataloguing paintings and works on paper for sale. And then after about 6 years, I left that auction house to become director of a small museum called the Ben Uri, which is the London Jewish Museum of Art, which has been going now for about 110 years. So I went from the commercial art world to the museum sector, a brief foray into that world. And then eventually in 2006, I was invited back to Sotheby's to become European head of the restitution department, which was actually a very small team globally of four people. So the work really found me. But looking back on my biography and my background, it's, I think, one that's ideally suited to me. I'm of German-Jewish stroke Polish-Jewish background on my mother's side. She came to England in 1939 on the Kinder transport. My undergraduate degree was in German, so unwittingly I'd equipped myself with one of the key languages of research in the field of provenance research and restitution within the 1933-45 arena. So biographically, linguistically, and art historically, having studied also modern art history, I seemed to be a perfect fit, but it wasn't a career I planned for. And as I always say, I've gone from therefore, from looking at the fronts of paintings and works on paper to looking at their backs. So what I look for now, unlike looking at the surface of a painting to see its condition or quality, I'm looking for marks, stamps, labels, or inscriptions that might help me and my colleagues to fill in gaps in the ownership history, particularly between 33 and 45.
And so restitution in the context of your work is a slightly different thing, if I understand it, to restitution in the museum context. So can you tell us about what restitution is for you?
That's a very good question. I often feel that the two biggest auction houses that have restitution departments, as they're called, have the title of the department as a slight misnomer, because the auction houses in question, such as Christie's, don't, of course, usually own the artworks that they're offering for sale on behalf of consigners, whether those consigners be private individuals or galleries or institutions. We are simply conveying title from our consigner to our buyer if the lot is successfully offered for sale. So I feel what we really should be called is a provenance research department focusing on 1933-45 ownership inquiries. But we don't do the restituting. We do the quiet research that may lead to the settlement of a long-standing title claim emanating from a loss or forced sale or flight asset sale between 33 and 45. So we're really a research department leading to the uncovering of tainted artworks that are being offered in the commercial art world. We're there to detect problems before they get to the catalogue and get onto the auction block. So we're not the restitutors, we are the discoverers of unresolved taints.
Because you can't, of course, as you say, give the stuff back. You can't give the art back to where it ethically would belong. And I think that's so interesting because it must be incredibly complex discovering what the correct ethical result would be. So how does that work?
When I began my career in the commercial art world in 97, I often sat in the library, in the Impressionist Modern Art Library, looking at old auction catalogues from Christie's, Sotheby's, Phillips Bonhams, European auction houses, particularly in France and Germany. And I was astounded to find, these are catalogues from the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s, endless Jewish surnames in the pre-war ownership history of the works of art that I was looking at. And I sat there thinking, as a man of Jewish background, what on earth happened to those people behind those names who once owned these works printed in these old catalogues? And broadly speaking, even at the time I joined the commercial art world, very little thinking was being devoted to that very complex, difficult question. It took until the end of 1998 for a conference to be organized in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the Clinton administration called the Washington Conference on Holocaust-era Assets, where this very question was addressed: what happened to artworks owned by Jewish collectors in what became Nazi Europe? What happened to the individuals and families that had owned these things? So it took until 1998 for this question to be looked at more officially. And one of the key achievements of that multi-day event in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the State Department was the drafting by a man called Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, who had convened the conference on behalf of the Clinton administration. He drafted a set of 11 Washington principles, which are moral ethical codes, essentially, that my team and I work to. They tell the world what needs to be done in terms of addressing unrecovered Nazi-era loot, primarily cultural artifacts. And one of the key phrases embedded within those 11 moral ethical codes in Clause 8, which is the phrase just and fair solution. So if we discover a work of whatever kind, whether it's a drawing, a work on paper, a sculpture, a tapestry, a carving, that has been consigned for eventual sale at Christie's, and we realize that it was either looted from a Jewish collector between 33 and 45, or it was sold in a so-called Jew auction between those years, or sold as a flight asset as the individual or family fled for their lives from Nazi Europe, we have to explain the matter to the consigner, the current owner, and encourage them to enter into a dialogue with the claimant side in the spirit of Clause 8 of the Washington Principles, this just and fair provision, to try and achieve a remedy that more often than not is a financial one. So oftentimes the work will proceed into a catalogue and therefore into a sale with a settlement in place. So it will say this lot is sold pursuant to a settlement between the current owner and the heirs of X, Y, or Z. And that's a financial settlement between the two parties. Restitution outright is actually quite rare in the auction context. Occasionally it does happen. The current owner is so, I suppose, horrified to be owning a piece of unrecovered Nazi loot that they decide to give the thing back wholly to the claimant side. But that happens probably 1 in 100 times.
That's what the scope of the material we're talking about and how it comes about. It's referred to in the Washington Principles as being confiscated by the Nazis or the fascists or their allies. But is there a range between the stuff that was simply stolen or simply confiscated without compensation and material which is sold in various circumstances, which may have been at a forced reality, a forced sale, where the owners had no choice but to sell it under valuation, or there may be situations which are more complicated than that, that it was sold by the bank or what have you?
In the 18 and a bit years that I've worked in this field, I have noticed a broadening out of definitions. So the idea of confiscation has been, I think, widely expanded in the almost 2 decades that I've worked in this field. I think that confiscation was the key word early on, around the time that the Washington Principles were published at the beginning of 1999. And the definition of that has expanded tremendously. And the definition of duress might previously have been thought about after the institution of the Nuremberg race laws in 1935. I think early on it was thought that Jewish citizens in Germany were generally much freer before 1935. They still had their professions, etc., and therefore were less likely to have been subject to duress sales out of financial need. But that's now been rethought, and any sale by a Jewish collector in Nazi Germany or and later Nazi Europe after the 30th of January 1933 is now looked at as problematic unless one can prove otherwise. The otherwise might be a Jewish dealer who still had an active trade from his or her gallery, but more often than not, any sale by a Jew in Nazi Germany and later Nazi Europe must be looked at as potentially problematic after now, 30th of January 33, when Hitler became Chancellor. So the definitions have definitely broadened over the last 26 years since the Washington Conference Principles were published.
And in terms of understanding where and how the boundary is drawn, I appreciate that a lot of the work in the Christie sense is likely to be then lead into a negotiation. But are there precedents? Do the Spoliation Advisory Panel reports help in terms of deciding how you approach the issues?
I think you're perhaps asking about financial settlements and what the sort of levels are depending on the circumstances of loss. I would say these days, the settlements don't differ hugely between an outright confiscation and a duress sale, either at auction in Berlin in 1941 or the item being sold as a Jewish collector fled Nazism for France, say, in 1938 or 39 and sold via a dealer there. That would still be regarded as a duress sale, and the financial settlement wouldn't differ hugely from if the object had been confiscated by the Gestapo, say, in 1941. That being said, all the settlements that we orchestrate quietly between consignor, obviously with their direct involvement, and claimant side are really on a case-by-case basis. So just because it is a financial settlement of X percent was awarded to the claimant side 5 years ago by a private consignor doesn't mean that the same percentage will necessarily be countenanced by the next consignor who encounters a work that they own with a problem emanating from the same family loss. It's really on a case-by-case basis.
And am I right in thinking that really the whole of this restitution rests on people just sort of wanting to do the right thing, and that there's no real legal framework here? They're not being sued for it, so it's optional.
Optional would be one word to use. Yes. I mean, I must add, as you both know, that I'm not a lawyer. I'm an art historian of sorts. But one must remember that the events of these losses, or forced sales or flight asset sales, were more than 8 decades ago. So in almost every jurisdiction that one can think of, where an owner might now own a work with an unresolved Nazi retaint hanging over it, it's very hard to litigate in a court to seek redress from a claimant perspective because of the passage of time and often the multiple changes of ownership between the event of loss and the current owner today. It might have passed through 6, 7, or 8 hands. So the only usable remedy in most jurisdictions now is not one through litigation in the courts, but it is using the letter and spirit of the 11 Washington principles, and particularly Clause 8's just and fair provision, which probably at times infuriates lawyers with its wooliness and vagueness, you know, just to whom, fair to whom. But it's what we have, and I suppose at best lawyers would regard it as soft law, but it does have, from my perspective, tremendous moral, ethical force. And of course, auction house provenance research and restitution specialists do have an advantage in that when we encounter a work with a problem, it's already been consigned to us for sale. And when we encounter the problem is usually, almost invariably, the first time that the owner, the would-be consignor, encounters the problem too. So momentum has already begun. Someone's decided to sell something. They come to Christie's to sell it. We uncover a problem. We explain it clearly, either directly to the owner or through the expert department specialists who explain the matter to the owner. We encourage a dialogue between Christie's and the owner and the claimant side. We often act as sort of neutral intermediaries, or sometimes they decide to have a direct contact with the claimants themselves or their representatives. And not every time, but more often than not, they do decide to engage and ultimately to reach a resolution with the claimant side. It can take weeks, months, or indeed years sometimes. But as I say, we have the advantage that when we encounter a problem, and therefore when the owner encounters a problem, they've already decided to offer something for sale. So there's a momentum there that we can then seize, quite different from a museum's perspective, where they're quietly possessing an object and have done so often for decades. And they're then approached by a claimant group, by a lawyer, or by a charity that represents claimant groups. There's no momentum there. The object is sitting quietly in a museum. So it's quite a different sort of narrative.
In the sense that the seller has already made up their mind, they're preparing to part with it. Depends, of course, how much they paid to acquire it in the past, but any arrangement becomes a matter of sharing out the profits rather than being dispossessed of something which you've treasured and you want to hang on to. So that's the momentum point, isn't it?
Yes. It's, as I said earlier on, it's very rare that there's a full restitution from a private consignor to a set of heirs. But that's also from the heir's perspective, because by now, 80 years after their family or an individual within their family lost an item to confiscation or was forced to sell it because of their Jewish background, there might now be 10, 15, 20 heirs spread around the world. So even if the current owner was willing for some reason to fully restitute the painting or drawing or sculpture or tapestry, one can't really imagine a scenario when a sort of timeshare arrangement between the heirs, Vancouver, Adelaide, Brisbane, Paris, would work. So that's why a financial settlement between the current owner, Christie's consignor, and the claimant side is usually the most logical one.
And presumably, if the auction house isn't happy with any solution, they're just going to refuse to sell it.
Yeah, I'm often asked that sort of question. I mean, we sometimes encounter pre-1933 Jewish ownership of an object in Germany, say, and then the trail goes cold in maybe 31 or 32. The last known pre-Nazi era owner was a man or a woman with a Jewish surname, say, but we can't fill in the gap, say, until 1954 when the work emerges in Switzerland on the art market or something. If we can't fill the gap, if we're unsure, and we can't be certain that we're going to be passing good title from our consignor to our buyer, almost invariably we wouldn't allow that object into the sale until somehow the puzzle had been solved. We don't just rush things in because there's still a lack of clarity. We hold things back, and we need to be as sure as we can be that we're able to convey good title between our consignor and our buyer, and that we're abiding in the spirit and letter of the Washington Principles.
So that puts the sort of the research you're doing not simply what happened to the item between 33 and 45, but what's then happened to it subsequently, which is to do a large part of the work of the auction houses of establishing title. But the likelihood is in that period, title will have, even if it was confiscated or stolen, that title will have been established because of the laws in the particular place where the transactions took place, which either allowed passing of title or limitation periods kicking in. It's difficult to construct scenarios where now somebody hasn't established good title along the path. I think Julie Cooper managed to do that in one of her novels, but it does require a bit of imagination to do that. But part of the role of the auction house is ensuring that they are selling items which have got a good title.
Yeah, of course, one of the first responses from a current owner, Christie's consignor, upon hearing that they own an artwork with an unresolved Nazi era taint will be, well, I bought this 20 years ago and surely I have full legal title to it, which, when one analyzes the situation strictly legally, I'm sure is correct. I think there are one or two jurisdictions where you can't acquire good title from a thief, such as the USA. But in almost every other jurisdiction, I think, because of the passage of time, you can. And that's why, mercifully, we have the Washington Principles and their moral ethical force to sort of sidestep the strict legal definitions and constrictions that we face. So there's no coincidence, of course, that departments such as mine were set up not long after the 1998 Washington Conference, simply because our sort of work within the international art market wasn't possible before then. We didn't have the tools because of the passage of time, legal title questions.
And do you have a favourite story of how the Washington Principles have been implemented or from your work?
Obviously, I've been doing this sort of work for almost 20 years, so the stories are many. But I think, broadly speaking, one of the most profoundly moving aspects of my team's work is when we're able to reunite a family, not just with information about a particular artwork that they then might well go on to share a part of the proceeds of through sale at Christie's, but even more importantly, from my perspective, having spent much of my life researching my mother's Jewish family's past, we're able often to tell them stories about their own ancestors, their own family history that had been forgotten or erased. And that happens many times a year. Very occasionally in my work in this field, I've experienced examples where a family, a group of heirs, say in the USA, weren't, as far as I can tell, even aware that they were really of Jewish background or part Jewish background. Through restitution, not necessarily from us, but say state restitution from Holland, they've learned about a grandparent's family history that they knew nothing about. And that's profoundly moving. But on a sort of item-specific basis, I once had the great pleasure to introduce the elderly grandson of a Jewish family from Berlin who had sent their old master paintings collection from Berlin to a museum in Holland called De Lakenhal in Leiden, where the entire collection was subsequently seized in 1941 by the incoming Nazi forces. I was able to introduce him to a painting that his grandparents had owned in Berlin and then had lost in that 1941 looting event at the Lachenhall Museum in Leiden. And he stood in front of it with me in the old master painting's basement for the first time in his life. And he was probably a man in his early 80s, and there were certainly tears in his eyes when he stood there for the first time in front of this work that the family had been looking for since 1941. So these are very, very powerful human encounters. And I never lose sight of that aspect of what we do, the human emotion, the sort of quiet human drama that descends from the suffering that their parents or grandparents went through. Because, of course, it's really shaped my own biography. Having come from a family where my grandmother was deported to her death in Minsk, my mother came to England on the Kinder transport, my great aunt died in the Warsaw ghetto. These stories have shaped my own biography, so I never forget that what we're doing is really about that. So it's reuniting individuals with artworks, but also reuniting them with their own family stories that have often been forgotten or erased.
It's incredibly important work, and it's also humbling for lawyers to hear, because it's obviously, as we've discussed, it's not really about law. It's about something more important.
Richard, thank you very much for taking us through what is a means of providing some recompense for one of the most horrifying events of the 20th century, which still has its impacts.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.